Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Tonight we join a conversation among fiction writers about the domestic drama, based on the observation that American novelists are preoccupied with the tale of our mostly dysfunctional families, whether they are families of origin or families of one's own making. But unfortunately, contrary to Tolstoy's famous assertion, a lot of these unhappy families are starting to seem exactly alike. So how is a writer to rediscover the way to tell a true, new, and enduring story of our most prized institution? As I said, after our guest conversation, we'll open it up to you so that you can bring your own mostly dysfunctional families, just kidding, into the discussion. We're fortunate to have Antonia Nelson, one of the New Yorker's 20 young fiction writers of the new millennium. She is the author of 8 books of fiction, and her works include Female Trouble and the novels Talking in Bed, Nobody's Girl, and Living to Tell. She's the recipient of many awards, including the Ray Award for Short Fiction, the Flannery O'Connor Award, the O. Henry, the Pushcart, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. And her new book of short stories, Nothing Right, features unforgettable characters who try to keep themselves intact as their personal lives crumble around them. The maintenance of family ties, the complicated love between parents and children, and the beauty of daily life are all on display in her fine stories. And I'm sure many of you saw the wonderful piece by Susan Reynolds this week in the LA Times, which talked about her wonderful work. Joining Antonia Nelson is Marisa Silver, author of the novel The God of War. The protagonist of Silver's novel, 12-year-old Aries Ramirez, lives with his mother and younger brother in a trailer alongside the Salton Sea. The New York Times observed that, like Joan Didion, Marisa Silver finds metaphors for disconnection in Los Angeles' arid sprawl. And The God of War, as many of you know, has just been nominated for a Los Angeles Times Book Award in fiction, so we congratulate Marisa for that. Marisa Silver left Harvard after 2 years to co-direct a documentary film for PBS entitled Community of Praise. She then wrote and directed her first feature film called Old Enough, which won the top prize at the Sundance Festival. She went on to direct 3 more feature films, Permanent Record, Vital Signs, and He Said, She Said. And then she left directing to pursue writing and made her fictional debut in The New Yorker. Her collection of short stories, Babe in Paradise, was published in 2001 and was named a Los Angeles Times Best Book of the Year. And in addition to The God of War, she's also the author of the novel No Direction Home. Moderating our discussion tonight is the wonderful and thoughtful Bernadette Murphy, a regular book critic for the LA Times who also teaches in the MFA and Creative Writing program at Antioch University. Bernadette has published 3 works of narrative nonfiction, and she's the author of an upcoming novel, Grace Notes, about music, motherhood, and madness. So please welcome Bernadette Murphy, Antonia Nelson, and Marisa Silver to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you all for being here tonight. It's wonderful to see you on a rainy night. And as Louise pointed out, thank you, Louise, for the fabulous introduction, by the way. We're going to talk about the family drama and what it is about dramas and families that draws us as readers and as writers. And I welcome our fabulous guests tonight. It's wonderful to see you. Before we get started on the discussion, I'm going to ask each of our authors tonight to read just a brief excerpt, like a 5-minute excerpt, set up the excerpt for you so that you have a taste of their work before we jump into our discussion. Would you like to go first, Tony?
Sure. I'm going to read the first few pages of the title story of this collection, and I think it's just maybe helpful to establish my interest in these days parents of teenagers, and a lot of the characters in this collection are the parents of teenagers. For me, the relationship between teenagers and the middle-aged is pretty startlingly intimate. Well, I just really understand what teenagers are going through. Anyway, this story is called Nothing Right, and I'm just going to read the first scene or two. Never shake a baby, the flyer insisted. Never, never, never. The public service brochures displayed at the district attorney's office seemed to be speaking to Hannah, each pertinent and personal. The face on Break the Cycle of Domestic Violence was one big yellow-blue bruise. Substance abuse abuses us all, another insisted, a martini glass with a slash through it. The illustration was so highly detailed as to include a toothpick-speared olive. Her 15-year-old son had demanded that Hannah wait rather than join him and his probation officer. Down the hall, a door banged open, a courtroom released. A young man in an orange jumpsuit emerged between two older, somber men, trailed by weeping women. His lawyers, his guards, his mother, sister, girlfriend. Like the brochures, this scene seemed a warning. Hannah had passed from one kind of life into another. A small boy brought up the rear of the procession, one hand hitching his pants, one swiping at his running nose. Hannah felt close to bursting into tears. 10 years from now, that little boy would be wearing the jumpsuit, leading the pack. Her own son seemed poised somewhere between these two, teetering. Ma, he brayed, suddenly beside her, nudging to indicate that his appointment had ended, they were free to go. Still free, Hannah thought, and her mood lifted. You take us to the most interesting places, she said as they exited the courthouse. This had been the third required monthly meeting since he'd made a bomb threat at school. Beside her, passing through the metal detectors, Leo pulled in a savoring breath. Good times, he murmured. He'd been to jail, he'd worn handcuffs. He had a psychologist, a lawyer, and a probation officer. This current round of meetings was part of something called diversion. And maybe it was sort of amusing. Leo's delinquency had to become something else, Hannah supposed, having already been terrifying, divisive, pricey, and heartbreaking. He was her second son, and he had never been the one she understood best. Recently, she had found herself disgusted by him. She didn't want to share a bathroom or kitchen, bar soap or utensils with her own boy. His brother, who'd passed through adolescence sobbing instead of shouting, had not prepared her for Leo. The pure ugliness of a more traditional male's transformation to manhood, the inflamed skin and foul odor, the black scowl, the malice in every move, might eventually convince a parent to despair, to say to that child, you are dead to me, because it would be easier, more decorous, acceptable, to mourn the loss than to keep waging a hopeless battle. Their next stop was Wichita Central High School. Leo's mother, the PE coach, greeted her. He was precisely as billed, soldier-like, down to the bullet-shaped shaved head and stiff-armed formality. G.I. Joe, her son called him. In his first period class, Leo had recently pierced his own lip with a safety pin. In the divot beneath his nose, a pulsing bump he'd tried to pass off as a bug bite and then a pimple. Finally, he'd just shown up at breakfast with the pin hanging there, clicking against his cereal spoon. A parent was required to come pay penance, help reclaim the old gymnasium. The smell alone could have brought back adolescence, sweat, fried food, patchouli. But this was also the high school Hannah had attended. Back then, this had been Central's only gym. In the years since, groups would intermittently creak open the metal doors and throw a party or host a science fair. The drama club had contributed a couple of sofas. Windows, metal barred and streaked with pigeon droppings, let through a gloomy cold light. Voices echoed. Hannah had played basketball here once upon a time. More recently, her first son had acted in plays on the very stage that today G.I. Joe would lead the group in dismantling. Leo's mother, meet Dylan's father. several fathers, Reagans, Megans, Dusties, and Jordans, a room full of uncomfortable men glancing around with their hands jammed in their pockets, awaiting instruction. Hannah couldn't help prescribing makeovers for everyone. First, 20 pounds off each, that defeated weight of middle age, of parenthood. Next, therapy and SSRIs all around. Hannah knew that whatever she saw as deficits in these people, they themselves recognized. They, too, wished not to seem sad and skittish. They wished they were trim and brave and confident. They wished they were young, not as young as their offspring, these children, clustered and glowering 50 paces away, also in the proverbial doghouse, but younger than their 40 or 50 years. They knew their best years had passed, that they'd been sapped of something vital, and now could only make futile guesses at how to get it back.
Thank you. There. Thank you. What a great introduction to our topic tonight. And now Marissa Silver will read to us from her new novel, God of War.
I guess I should set this up a little bit just by telling you a little bit about the novel. It takes place in the Salton Sea, which is about 3 hours east of here, I'm sure, in the desert. And it's about a family, a mother named Laurel and her 2 sons, Ares, who's the protagonist of the book, who's 12, and his younger brother Malcolm, who's 6. And Malcolm is mentally impaired. And I guess the other thing you need to know is that Richard is Laurel's boyfriend who lives in a trailer in an area called Slab City, which is near the Salton Sea. And I'm trying to think if you need to know anything else. You know what? The book is told retrospectively from the adult Ares point of view. That night, I woke to the noise of Malcolm's scream. I waited for the reassuring clump of Laurel's feet to hit the ground, for the sound of the card curtain to flutter noisily apart, for her groggy, soothing voice to urge Malcolm deeper into sleep. But Malcolm screamed again. "Mom!" I yelled, stumbling out of bed and into the living room. My underwear was twisted around my hips, and I tried to write things as I felt for Malcolm in the dark. He was sitting up on the couch, hitting his leg with his hand. "Spy, spy, spy," he said. "Mom!" I called. I was angry that I had to be the one to get out of bed in the middle of the night to take care of my brother. I gathered him to my chest and began to rock him, holding his arms tight to his body the way my mother had taught me to do, so that he didn't scratch or hit himself. I risked letting go with one hand, then snapped on the light above the couch. I was not supposed to try to wake him out of one of his night terrors, but they scared me. When in the grip of one, he appeared to be awake, but he wasn't. His eyes were open, but he did not see me. I felt frightened that my own perceptions would desert me, too. The card curtain was drawn open, the sweep of it pulled to one side and caught by a hook so that it resembled the way girls at school lodge their hair behind an ear. Laurel's bed was untouched. She was out having sex with Richard. She usually left after she thought Malcolm and I were asleep. I knew she would come home in a few hours, creeping into the trailer, thinking I had no idea where she had been or what she had been doing, because she didn't know so many things about me. Like the fact that I knew what a blowjob was and how men had sex with other men. She was unaware of the actual curriculum of my grade, thought I was learning something about American history and diagramming sentences, when in fact I had recently learned how to spell fellatio, and sometimes I got a bathroom pass in order to lock myself in a stall and jerk off. That Laurel had sex with Richard in his Airstream in Slab City was the only information I held over her, but it was useless as any kind of bargaining chip, because if I told her that I knew, she would simply smile and ruffle my hair. She wasn't like the TV mothers who ferociously guarded their children against the realities of the body and the strange and sometimes unsightly acts it performed. She walked around the trailer in her underwear and peed with the bathroom door open. During his terrors, Malcolm was somehow more present than he ever was during the day. He looked at me as though he was about to say something, maybe even explain what he had been thinking about all his life. But I knew not to make the mistake of hoping. Hope was only a selfish desire to escape the misery of my culpability. And I knew from reading 12 Angry Men, which I found in the trash outside the library because some kid had crossed out angry and replaced it with horny, that I could not be found innocent. The evidence was stacked against me. "Spy, spy, spy," he repeated. "There are no spies in here," I said, rocking my brother, although it was unlikely that he was actually talking about a spy. I was used to taking his sounds and gestures and inventing logic around them. That is what my mother and I did. We created Malcolm's world for him and pretended we were right. He wants juice, Laurel would say, if he smacked his lips in the direction of the refrigerator, if the day was especially hot, or if she happened to be thirsty herself. But what if she was wrong? What if Malcolm wanted the opposite of juice? What if he didn't want at all? His body changed from being a heavy lump in my arms into something stiff with the architecture of will, and I knew that the terror was over. Hey, man, I said. He looked towards Laurel's room. She's not here now. He whimpered. You had a dream. I was certain this was wrong. The terrors were not dreams, not even nightmares. They were more like the moment when a cartoon character ran off a cliff before he started to fall. They were a seizure of understanding. I believe that during those nocturnal episodes, my brother realized that he was trapped by useless fixations, by the need to make the sound ba over and over again, or to count peas. I thought that if I were in his situation, I'd be frightened all the time. But I knew that in order to have fear, you had to care about things never changing from the safe and predictable way they were. And it was not Malcolm who cared about this, but me. So it turned out that Malcolm was lucky. I was the one who was scared to death. In many ways, I was envious of my brother. He could move through a crowd of people without touching anybody, like a falcon darting through a forest at full speed, never getting snagged on a branch or crashing into a tree trunk. Some days, I would try to see how long I could go without the feel of another person on my skin. On those mornings, I woke up, dodged my mother's pets and adjustments, her hand running up my back or along the line of my jaw, as if I were one of her beloved desert plants. At school, I tried to walk the halls without brushing up against another person. When my teachers passed back homework, I was careful to take the paper without touching their hands. But after half a day of this physical abstinence, my body craved contact so that almost without realizing it, I would move into the path of an oncoming student in the hallway or sit too close to someone during lunchtime, suffering his derision just to rid myself of that terrible feeling of isolation. How did Malcolm do it? Malcolm, who needed everything, needed nothing. He fell asleep in my arms and I laid him down and tucked the sheets around him. Then I made my customary rounds to check that the oven was off and the door locked. I checked each more than once because sometimes when I was alone and nervous, I believed it was possible for air to move an oven knob or for some strange force to unlock the door. Safety seemed like a slippery thing, something that was there one moment and then not. Headlights washed over the house, brightening the windows, and the sound of tires crunching on the rubble driveway swelled, then stopped. The car engine cut out and the trailer fell into darkness again. The engine ticked gently as the driver's side door made its customary squeal. I snapped off the light over Malcolm's couch and ran into my bedroom just as Laurel entered the trailer. She barely made a sound. I imagined her holding her suntan hirachis to her chest, tiptoeing past Malcolm so as not to disturb what she imagined was his eventless sleep. I considered calling out, letting her know that I was on to her and that she had not been there to take care of Malcolm when he needed her most. But there was nothing to be gained by trying to pin blame on my mother. Fault would eventually redound to me. The card curtain made a noise like 1,000 tumbling dominoes as she let it fall from its hook.
Thank you. So these excerpts that we've heard get us warmed up for the topic of family drama. And it makes me curious, just to hear your thoughts, is what makes us hungry as writers and as readers to explore the family drama? We've all grown up in one kind of family or another and seen what other families look like outside of ours. Why is it, what is the draw that makes us so hungry to explore families in drama, in literature?
Well, it's my sense that, I think when you say us, what you're talking about maybe is maybe it's peculiarly American preoccupation, and sometimes that's a critique that's leveled against American fiction, that it occupies itself too much with the family and not enough with what people like to label the rest of the world or political drama. But I think for us, in some way, it is political drama. I mean, it is the institution we're most intimate with in some way and the place where a lot of our personal battles are lodged. I mean, we have not as many immediate threats to us that aren't coming from family or institutions that wish to suggest families are our most beloved and are most under assault a lot, I think. I don't know. But.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple things also. I think that in times past, there were so many more strictures on life that there are, than there are now. I mean, there were class strictures, mm-hmm. there were racial strictures. I mean, these things exist, but not to the extent that they did. And I don't think that they fuel fiction in America mm-hmm. in the same way that they once did. And so I think that in certain ways, we turn to family, as Tony said, as a replacement for those kinds of dramatic rubrics that right. you need in fiction. I mean, you need the enemy, you need the person who's fighting against something. And because in this country, you know, obviously we don't have wars waged on our soil, we don't have a lot of what happens in other countries, that as Tony said, that's the place where we find those sorts of things that used to be provided by, you know, the rich boy marrying the poor girl, or the black kid, you know, falling in love with the white girl, or, you know, certain things that provided that kind of drama that are hard to, that really don't right now, or do in a much subtler way. And in the other way, I think that, you know, we're a particularly, I think we're a pretty psychologically based culture. Mm. And I think that, you know, we look to family to figure out who we are. You know, I think that we are all these are huge generalizations and obviously not true of everybody. But, you know, I am this way because my mother did this to me. My dad did this to me. This was my parent. You know, we look for those kinds of ways of understanding who we are. And so I think a natural outgrowth of that is for writers or artists in different ways to explore, you know, who we are, what our identity is in relationship to our family.
Right. I had lunch with a friend last week and was talking about preparing for this program and said, you know, what do you think? Why is it we're interested in these books? And she said the reason she was interested in stories of families, especially messed up families, was because you could take solace in feeling, well, at least I'm not like that. You know, at least as a mother, I'm not, you know, that way, or my kids aren't that bad. Do you think that holds some credence?
I don't know. When I read stories about messed up families, I think, oh, I am like you know, I guess I see more commonality in the mistakes and the foibles of people yeah. than in, you know, there is obviously no perfect family. There's no there's no family that gets through unscathed. And you know, so I guess in a funny way, I think that exposing the mess of families is a way of sort of exposing all of our messes. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I remember when the term dysfunctional as applied to families started being very, you know, very much how people expressed their feelings about family. And I can remember when that happened that I couldn't think of a family that didn't, you know, conform to the idea of dysfunctional, which led me to think that if everyone is dysfunctional, then it can't be dysfunctional, because dysfunctional suggests that there's functional, you know, or that... For me, it's more that you identify yeah. or that there's an element of identification, although I think there are plenty of books that push at that, either to become wacky in a way that is not interesting to me, a kind of, you know, cartoonish dysfunctionality, or, you know, the family as a group of misfits who've all managed to find one another and shack up together and create some new group of people who in essence becomes the new family. I understand the impulse, and I think that's a very common impulse in writing, to make groups solidify, that there's some rupture at the beginning of a book, and by book's close there will be constitution of society, a reimagined society, a new social order, which in our culture I think usually conforms to the idea of family. Yeah.
And do you
aspirational.
Find... I'm sorry?
Aspirational,
yeah.
That we somehow... I think there's something else, too, which is that... And I think this was, you know, something that drove me when the novel before this one is called No Direction Home. And, I think a lot about the fact that families in America really don't stay together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a huge amount of movement, and there's a huge amount of migration, you know, into a city, away from a city. You don't live with your grandmother and your, you know, aunts and uncles, by and large. You tend to, you know, the goal is to actually leave. Yeah. The goal is to move away. And so maybe part of the impulse to write about family is to try to figure out, well, what is family in the face of that dispersion? Mm. And what is it, you know, how do we make families? I mean, sometimes, you know, a family is made up of not related people. Yeah. And that can be a domestic drama as well. And so I think, you know, for me, you know, I think a lot about that. Well, what are the root, what are we searching for in the idea of family? What is the deep thing that we want out of it. It's not necessarily a blood relation. Right. It's something, it's a kind of connectedness that, that our social landscape sometimes defies.
Mm-hmm. I was teaching at Antioch back in December, and Dorothy Allison came as and did a seminar there. And she did an entire, you know, a couple-hour-long seminar on the concept of home. And her thesis statement for it was that all good literature has home as its center, that either we've experienced home at some point in our life and have lost it and we're trying to regain it, or we know the concept of home exists and it's about the character trying to get that concept, even if they'd never experienced it earlier. Do you find that to be true in your work and in the literature that interests you?
I think it must be true of my work, although I'm not sure I thought about it quite that way. The most recent novel I wrote, you know, when I started it, I had three things in mind, and a lot of other stuff came about in the process of drafting it. But a couple of things were to try to write around cliches, to just say, you know, in fact, grandmas really matter to a great many people, and dead grandmothers are sort of sacred beings, and all of my undergraduate students are dying to write about their dead grandmothers. And it's very difficult to say to them, you know, you can't write about your dead grandmother. There's just nowhere to go with a dead grandmother. And I decided I would try to write, because I think it's a genuine emotion that becomes sentimental very quickly. And so one of my challenges was to write about a dead grandmother and try not to make her sentimental, because I think it's a genuine sentiment frequently. Okay, so that was one. One was that the baby would not be a cute baby and ugly baby. But the third was the idea that the family is such a powerful institution, and home as an institution. And I think this is something that I've written about unconsciously for a really long time, that the family unit is a more powerful force than a lot of other institutions and forces, and then the setting for that would be the home. That, you know, these characters in that novel are forced to be together in their home, and one of them has been released from prison. So he's paid his civic dues. He's paid his dues and come home as far as the world is concerned. But being home, he has some additional dues to pay, and that's actually the more punitive, significant, exacting crowd. You know, and for me, I guess his literal return to his home is absolutely the most important thing that this kid has to get past. He killed the grandma. That's, you know.
Wow.
It was an accident.
Okay. But it brings up the question about writing about things of family. You know, how does one write about things that are so easily cliched, that could be a Hallmark card so easily, and do it in a way that's not a cliche, or that is interesting and alive and vibrant and true, and not just true in the way we, like you said, we can love our grandmother and miss a dead grandmother, but that, how do you write about it in a way that's arresting and gets people's attention?
Well, I think one of the ways you do it is by, you know, not writing to an idea, but writing to specific people. Yeah. I mean, you know, all stories of family are obviously about love and about anger and about law. You know, they all have all those things. But if you're writing those themes, you're not going to be writing anything very interesting. But if you're writing particular characters, if you're writing, you know, particular obstacles that the characters run into, I mean, that's where any story takes on its life. That's where, you know, the juice comes from anything. And in a funny way, you know, I mean, I never write about an idea. You know, I only know the theme of my book after someone has told me what it is, you know. So it's really not about, I mean, I didn't set out to write, I wrote about this particular family, right, this group of people. They all had a very particular situation with this child who was mentally impaired, and the older boy thinks that he's responsible. And so, but you know, I didn't sit there going, well, you know, this has got to be about love, or it's got to be about, you know, loss. But one thing I wanted to say in you know, response to the lecture that Dorothy Allison gave, I mean, I think one of the reasons why home is such a prominent idea is because, you know, it's kind of the first act of rebellion that any child mm-hmm. has. Mm-hmm. And in your life, you know, every single one of us has had to break away in one way or another, whether we've ended up living with our families or not living with our families, we've had to make that choice to individuate. And you know, that's the root of so much literature. Mm-hmm. I mean, it certainly is what I wrote about. You know, it's about a boy who has to make a choice whether to be the responsible one for his brother or to break away and suffer the loss and the issues that come up when he breaks away. But I think that in so much of literature everywhere, I mean, that's really kind of the first act of rebellion, the first obstacle that you overcome in your life. Okay. So, I mean, it's no wonder that so much of literature is about that.
Well, and literature itself deals with the human condition. I mean, if it's not dealing with the human condition, we're probably not very interested in it. And where do we learn about the human condition in the first place but in our families?
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to mention something from both your books. In Antonia, your stories sometimes feature large, rambling homes and characters who are sort of outside that family environment, wanting to be part of the environment and wanting to belong to it. And there's one story from her collection called Or Else, and the main character is David, and he stands outside this Telluride vacation home belonging to his childhood friend Priscilla, a home he badly wants to be inside of. He's standing in the snow with his lover Danielle, and this is what taken from the text. "Looking in like this reminds me of a snow globe," Danielle said, quiet and low, "except we're in the snow and they're in the globe." There'd been drinks with dinner. David had held her hand happily, quietly. He wished Priscilla would step onto the porch and discover his happiness. He needed to display it, to prove it. That's the end of the quote. What I want to bring up is, what is the essential quality of longing that your stories tell us about? The wanting to belong to that seemingly large, happy family across the street or at the vacation home or these other places that it always seems the grass is greener somewhere else. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I grew up in a large house and a large family that actually has a summer home in Telluride, and it isn't as if I somehow wanted to place a character on the outside of that and go, envy us. You know, I think it's more maybe the idea of the writer's sensibility, which is to often feel, I think, I won't speak for either of you, but for me, having grown up reading a lot and finding most of my intimates in books, that I often feel like that John Barth character in Lost in the Funhouse, poor little Ambrose, who can only observe and wish that he could enjoy the funhouse, but instead be charged with plotting out the story that would be written about going to the funhouse, or the mechanic charged with building the funhouse. And so for me, the position of David in that story is the position of the person on the outside of some sort of action or some sort of enjoyment of living life, rather than being the person who observes it, takes note, and knows somewhat what everybody is thinking or has guesses about it. And, you know, there's some, I guess, pleasure in being that person, but really a lot of the time I think writers are wishing they could just join the party instead of being the person
taking
charged
notes
with, like,
about the party.
Taking notes about it. But that desire to be in it rather than observing is a characteristic that doesn't seem to me unique to me among the writers I know.
Yeah, And Marissa, in your book, I was touched really deeply about Aries and his struggle and his so badly wanting to make things right, and all the ways he tries and all the different ways he's working to make things right in the family. Yet, he's never going to make things right. Maybe you talk a little bit about that sort of longing that the character and that we as a human people have to try to fix our families, to try to improve things, to and then the existential emptiness that comes when you realize it can't be done.
Yeah, I mean, it is a, you know, in the novel, Aries feels that he is responsible for his brother's impairment, and therefore he takes on this enormous responsibility for his brother, also because his mother's kind of a little bit wayward and doesn't take on the kind of responsibility that you might expect her to. And I think that what he undergoes this, you know, for him, the struggle of the book is to say, who am I in relationship to this family? Am I a separate person? Am I part of it? Do I have to be intricately bound up with them to be a family? Can I be separate from them and be a family? And I think it's a struggle that everyone goes through, even not just when they're a child, but at every stage in their life. You know, when you have an aging parent and you have to draw the line between how much you're going to care for them and how much you're going to maintain your own life and your own relationships. And I mean, we all have these moments where the lines become very gray and our sense of responsibility for the people we love is counterbalanced by our sense of, you know, losing ourselves, losing our individuality, which we've struggled all our lives for. And I think those issues are constant. I don't think that they simply happen in adolescence. I think they start in adolescence and they probably start when you're an infant. And you know, some therapists would say that. But I mean, you know, I think that's the constant process of life. And I think that once you've made that quote unquote separation from your family, you actually haven't. And that it's a continual act of separating. And the rules change as people change and problems come up and health issues come up. And it's an ongoing issue of separation. So I guess that's the larger existential issue in the book, is really about responsibility and how are we responsible to the ones that we love, and what does it mean to say, I'm not going to take on this responsibility? Does that mean that you don't love them? And does that mean that the family is irreparably ruptured or not? In this case, it's ruptured in a certain way. These characters split apart as they become adults, and they don't really have much to do with each other in the intimate way that they once did. But they're always a family, and the thing that drives each of them, no matter when, even if they're separate, is that central relationship. So I don't think it ever leaves us, no matter whether we stray far or not.
In reading both your books, the thing that struck me, and especially after speaking to my friend and who said, you know, she thinks we read to realize we're not as bad as that, is that what I get out of the books that really touch me that deal with family drama is the sense of compassion, the sense of, oh, I've done that too, or I'm like that, or I could understand how Aries would be the way he is, or I could understand how David would stand out there and look at this. And when I get that sense of compassion, it sort of dilates my compassion, not only to the people in my life, my immediate family, but to myself and the errors I make as a human being in family. Do you think that that is one of the reasons we're interested in family dramas, that to open ourselves up more to the world and to how...
I think that's why we're interested in literature.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that when we read to... I don't know, when I read, I shouldn't say we, you know, when I close a book that I've loved, I feel like my entire, you know, my world has been expanded and my sense of what's possible and what you know, how people relate. And I can't always put my finger on it, but I feel enlarged.
Yes.
You know, in the way that you do when you see a beautiful painting or when you hear a piece of music, you feel enlarged. You feel like you are encompassing something maybe even ephemeral about the world that isn't in your everyday experience. So I don't think it's really particular simply to family drama. I think that it's literature in general. I think that's why we read.
Yes.
Tony?
Okay.
Yes. I agree.
One of the things that struck me also is that because of the way you both wrote, I ended up withholding judgment on characters that if they were my next door neighbor or they went to school with my kids or whatever, I might not have been as generous in my thoughts about the people. And that also gave me insight into why we read literature. Is that what some of these stories are good for, to take us out of the day-to-day stuff where we're filled with judgment and be more thoughtful of putting ourselves in someone else's shoes and seeing the world from their point of view?
Well, I think anybody who can, I mean, you know, what I most like is when I run into people not who want to engage in small talk, but who want to tell me a story. And typically what they recognize as a good story is something that they've experienced. And, you know, it defies some sort of cliched situation if it's a good story. It sort of pushes at something mysterious and compelling. And to me, the charge of just making a good story, you know, a good yarn, is enough to... What it demonstrates, a successful story demonstrates to you the way some people will do, you know, to paraphrase Flannery O'Connor, which is just endlessly fascinating to me. And whether that defies conventional wisdom, which is one of the ways I govern, you talked earlier about cliche, to me cliche also is part of a kind of conventional wisdom, and it's... For me, a lot of what makes premise happen is in defiance of conventional wisdom. When the first Gulf War started in 1991, my son was born that night, and nobody in the hospital was interested in his birth except me and him, and a nurse who happened to just be there as a helper. But anyway, everyone else was watching missiles land. But at the very same moment, another nurse at the hospital was plotting to kidnap a baby, and a week later did kidnap a baby from my little town's hospital. And that's the newspaper article I was tracking, the kidnapping of this baby. Everyone else was watching the war. But the thing that made it interesting to me was that she had kidnapped a twin. And, you know, as soon as you hear that, it's sort of like your apprehension of her complicates, because she didn't steal the whole thing. I mean, she left that family with a baby. I mean, I just thought, well, that's interesting. Like, now I understand her in some way, and I really wanted then to write about her. Not, I didn't want to make a nurse character, and I didn't want to inhabit the point of view of the nurse, but I wanted that situation to investigate it because it interested me, and that's where stories start for me. Somebody does something, or I hear something, or see something that sparks some particular interest in me. I don't know that I would have been as interested in that story if I hadn't just had a baby in that very same place, and probably, you know, past that same woman wandering around the halls of the hospital.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's, you know, the idea of story is that it doesn't happen to people who can't tell them, which I also think is true, and I'm always looking for some great story that illustrates human nature, even as it sort of perverts and transforms and converts what you would expect of somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I think you could deal with making grandma interesting. How is it that she was a little naughty in one way or another, you know?
Yeah, making the characters not black and white, where the minute, I'm sure you've read these books, where the minute you open it, you know who the bad guy is, who the good person is, how, you know, you can already sense where it's going to go, and you don't need to keep reading because it's pretty obvious from the get-go. But when I read a book that maybe I don't like the character in the beginning, but as it goes on, I start to be drawn in, and suddenly I adore the character by the end of it, or, you know, things that wake up my awareness so it's not just going on sort of what I already know.
Right. There's something else about reading, and I don't know if this pertains to anything that we're talking about, but, you know, so oftentimes people will say, you know, I wouldn't do that, or, you know, I don't understand why she did that, or I got why, you know, they talk about the characters as though they're real, which I guess is kind of what you aim for, except for fiction is fiction, and it exists in this kind of weird space between reality and the make-believe. And I think that one of the reasons why we like to read fiction is because it's sort of like a dreamlike state. You know, it's like that moment when you wake up and you're kind of half in the dream and half in real life. And we all love that moment. It's a very pleasant moment. It's a, you know, we relish it, and it's really evanescent. What is that word? It just disappears quickly. And I think fiction is like that. And I think that, you know, so it's not like, you know, your friend who said, you know, I look at the people and I think, oh, you know, I'm not like that. Well, I don't think that, I don't really read fiction and think the people are real. I think that it's kind of like in this separate limbo between reality, waking and dreaming, and that maybe there's more that I learn about myself in that little moment. There's more that I feel about living in that little moment of waking than in when I'm really awake.
Yeah.
So what about the charge that, you know, I mean, I sat in on a panel once at a conference where historians were taking to task historical novelists and saying to them, essentially, you write these books. It's sort of like what would be law, you know, what people would react to Oliver Stone, maybe, like saying, you take these actual events and you manipulate them and you make people convinced that that's what really happened, as opposed to the historians, you know,
saying what really
maybe
happened.
Drier prose. And, you know, with the historic, the novelist who I just adored saying, well, you guys should write better, you know, and then people would be so convinced by the fiction. They'd be convinced by textbooks of history.
But I do feel like when I read the newspaper, I'm very aware that the stories I'm reading are flat in some fashion, that I do not know the circumstance, and that somebody who's accused of shooting his mother and dragged off in cuffs, that there's like some much richer, larger story probably behind that, and that's where I think fiction has its role as being a little more truthful in some fashion, mm-hmm. to fill out those details that you know, the police blotter can only allude to.
So maybe to get back to our theme, you know, that the domestic novel has that ability where it takes, you know, what we all experience. We all, you know, in certain levels, we all experience the same thing. You know, yeah. We have these families, we have kids, we try to educate them, we try to make money to support, you know, there's a sort of, but that, you know, a great domestic novel that gets into the, you know, kind of integument of that life, yeah. tells us more about who we are as families.
Yeah, and some of the examples I've heard tonight, Louise brought up when we were talking about planning this, the whole newspaper phenomenon, media phenomenon around Octomom. And how maybe our fascination with what's going on with her speaks to our hunger to have the inside story, not only in her life, but in so many lives. And that as people are getting more and more of their news from short little soundbite pieces on the news or on television, that they're not getting the same kind of sustenance that we get when we read a piece of fiction that gives us that kind of insight. Do you think that fiction plays any sort of social role in getting us to take a step back and really think about the family institution in a way that's very different than getting the little MSNBC blurb on Octomom selling, I read today, the video of her birth for $1 million.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And wouldn't you really like to know the real story of Octomom?
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't you like to, you know, and we know this very, you know, we know so little about her and yeah. really so, you know, we all have such a judgment about her. Yeah. And it would be, you know, so somebody could write a pretty great novel about that.
But the way fiction gives us the insight into not being judgmental, but having compassion, you know, that if we can understand the whole context, maybe we have a different picture.
I think that is the fiction writer's urge, yeah. to figure out. I mean, my undergraduate, my beginning writing students very, very frequently write about homelessness. They don't write about homelessness. They write about a homeless character. And I think that that urge to understand how this person, this particular person they've witnessed or can imagine, became that person is almost always based in some desire to find empathy and connection with it.
Yeah.
It seems it's always the case that there may, I can't think of one time when that hasn't been a sympathetic inhabitation on their parts. And so I just think maybe the whole urge to write fiction to a large... I mean, Curtis Sutton-Feld's book, First Wife, is that what it's called? First Wife. First Wife? I think it just came out this year, right? American Wife. Thank you. American Wife. It's obviously based on Laura Bush, but the publisher was pretty fervent in making sure you knew that too. And in a way, I think it's just like, how is it that Laura Bush ended up with George Bush? You know, we all would like to know. And it's a very sympathetic portrait. You know, this woman who was a reader and, you know... What's funny to me is, like, reading the book, I was just like, I don't actually believe this story. And then in the other part of my mind, I'm like, but in fact, that character, like this, Laura Bush, actually yeah. did meet and marry. It was a very weird experience. And the kind of insistence with which the book was promoted as yeah. being a sort of fictional telling of right. Laura Bush's life, right. really, it's fascinating because I think the writer's idea was to find some way of explaining this relationship to right. herself, if not to the reading public,
good.
Sympathetically.
And by the same token, that's probably the same urge that has so many people turning into shows like Dr. Phil, to understand, to get... What is the difference?
I wonder if that's accurate.
Well, I'm
that actually is the place where I think people are more likely to say, at least I'm not that.
Right. What I'm wondering is, what is the difference then if the... Well, you may have a point there, that the curiosity to know about how other people live their lives and why they make the choices they do and to inform ourselves about a perspective other than our own seems to be similar.
You know, what I see in those shows, which is what I'm kind of interested in, this is like suddenly close, is really, I mean, I when I see those shows, I think, I don't think those people are Well, first of all, I don't think anybody really knows the truth of their life, mm-hmm. and that they're always, you know, the story that they're going to tell you about who they are is a combination of some real things that happened and their interpretation of it and the mythology that they would like to be seen as. And, you know, what compels me about writing characters is to try to understand self-perception and the mythologies that we weave around ourselves. So when I watch Dr. Phil, I think you're watching mythologies mm-hmm. being explored and being exposed to you. I don't think that people, there is no truth of any of us. So what's interesting is really how we present ourselves, and this has to do with family too. You know, we all choose a relationship, who we are in our family. You know, I'm the this one. Yeah. I was the uptight one. She's the happy one. He was the, you know, we all create these personalities that have to do with the mythology of that our family creates for us too, which is another thing that I think is so fascinating about the family drama, which is that it's really myth making. I mean, all of our families have are myths that we create and that have been created over generations. Mm-hmm. And we buy into the myths that we like and that serve us and that make us feel that we're special or that there's sort of an identity to this family. And we eschew the things that don't conform to that myth. And so I think it's kind of interesting, you know, from that point of view, to think about families is really kind of not unlike Greek myths. You know, it's not unlike the family of Zeus with all those crazy, you know, sons and daughters with, you know, coming out of his head or whatever they did. But, you know, but that's kind of also, I think, what is so compelling about writing about families is because it's writing about not a truth, it's writing about a mythology.
Can a novel or short story that's dealing with family drama have as its center something that isn't a big trauma? Like have a quiet trauma to it? Because so many of them are... You know,
that's
really
the beauty about families, isn't it? I mean, we were just talking about this wonderful novel by Peter Taylor called A Summons to Memphis, mm-hmm. which is an older, not old. It's about a man who's summoned back to his home in Memphis. He's a middle-aged man because his two middle-aged sisters are horrified because their older father is going to get married again. I mean, that's the whole drama. Yeah. And it's so fantastic because it hinges on this tiny thing that you're just sort of, you know, but as the book goes on, you understand why they feel that way, why they feel betrayed by the father, what all the, you know, kind of the little tiny dramas of that family were. But it's really hinges on a very insignificant thing. So absolutely. What do you think?
I agree. I agree. I mean, I could name any number of novels that are precisely told because you have to understand the subtle interior workings, which, you know, the novel and short story is the art form that privileges the interior life. You know, we don't actually have access to that. We don't have access to that very, very clearly, or as clearly, I don't feel, as we do in novels and stories, you know, that someone can just be sitting and thinking and you have access to what that person is feeling. And it's not true in film in the same way. It's not true in drama in the same way. It's pretty uniquely what happens in books, and it seems amazing to me, really remarkable. That I know people who don't experience that always startles me, that it mm-hmm. isn't a shared love. I assume since you're all sitting here that I'm among intimates who understand that feeling, but it just seems so peculiar to know people who don't read fiction in particular and have that experience of having a great many friends to call upon when, you know, you're feeling lonely in whatever fashion or bored or whatever. I mean,
yeah, I have a great love of quiet dramas, books that have something very, very simple at their center. And I've heard many people say, you know, stronger plot, you need bigger things happening. And there's something that I find very enjoyable in stories that just take me inside someone else's life and let me be there and hang out there with them for a while.
Yeah. I mean, look at Marilyn Robinson. She's,
yeah, know, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
Very little happens of consequence, but everything happens. So,
yeah. I think we're going to open it up to questions now. I believe there's a microphone out here that if you have a question, perhaps you could raise your hand and Justin will bring the microphone to you and we can hear your questions. I think there's one in front. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Do you ever get emotionally involved with your characters, you know, that they be so bad or sad that you're paralyzed or, you know, cannot function? you know, because of the character.
An editor once pointed out to me that my characters were crying an awfully lot in a novel, and I was realizing that I was just sort of permitting them to break down a lot in order to, you know, just relieve themselves of whatever issues they were having, or just, I don't know, whatever, some cathartic experience that just kept happening in the book. And once he pointed that out, they had to stop crying so much. And it made me a little sad for them, because it was sort of this, you know, restraint in some way that had been placed upon them. I can't say that I've ever been paralyzed by their predicaments. I mean, not me literally or in any kind of figurative sense, paralyzed by their. I mean, in plenty of instances, I've been driven to write because something has happened to somebody in the world or in my life that is overwhelming and awful. That's absolutely the case. But the fictional character could never be as debilitating to me as, you know, imagining that experience or even the mutation of the experience I start writing about. It's, for me, writing is a way of understanding mysteries and for, you know, getting to the bottom of my own reactions or trying to make some sort of peace. And so it's almost an opposite response, that I sort of feel better for having written about, you know, things that are in life fairly paralyzing and awful.
Also, you know, when you write, you're trying to get the reader to feel. And sometimes having the character feel deprives the reader of feeling. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
But, you know, if somebody's doing all the emoting for you, you don't get the chance to have your own aha moment and understand the emotion. So in a funny way, I find myself pulling back much more in terms of drama and emotional outlet for the characters than going forward and letting them really experience what maybe in real life they might, because I want that experience left for the reader.
Cool. We have one down here, please.
It's interesting that the last thing that you mentioned was about emotion, and I wanted you both to address that, because one thing about writing about families or thinking about families is that there's this load of irrational emotion that isn't allowed. Like, I mean, you would never, well, for example, the people in your family, you would never in your life choose to be your friend. They're just these odd people. And so that from the minute you're, you know, born and growing up with these people, there's these emotions that are irrational and grating on, you know, that build up and have this pressure because that they're not people that you would normally associate with.
Question. Was there a question? That was just a. Do you have any comments?
I think it's really. What is my thought about this? I've always liked a great many of my relatives. I will say that. And when I don't like them, I like the fact that other of my relatives can be sure to be counted upon to be on my side. I mean, there's something about having to encounter, I mean, as Marissa was saying earlier, the idea of there being a kind of mythic structure to family. And so, you know, the black sheep is actually a good figure to have a kind of group dislike of or pity for, and the prodigal and all the roles that make a kind of sense. So that when you reconvene, as my family does fairly regularly, you know, the improvement or the not improvement, the you know, decline of certain members, it's just fascinating to me. But, you know, for the same reason, when babies are born, there's like 100 people who love that baby without ever having seen it, you know, and like care 10 years later, 15 years later, when that baby is turned into somebody difficult, and then waiting around for that person to come around to being a normal adult or feeling very, very devastated when that doesn't happen. I mean, there's something about the commitment to the idea of family, regardless of who those people are, that is fascinating and important to me. And I do know, I have a lot of friends who are not entangled in their families, and it's their extended families. And both my husband and I don't think we would have married if we both didn't sense our very deep entanglement with one another. I mean, I think probably there are types of people who make their own families and feel perfectly fine having groups of friends who fill those roles. And then, you know, there's somebody like me who's just like, you know, when my cousin Norma died, I wasn't that sad, you know? And that was okay.
There's one back there.
I would address this to all of you, but especially Melissa, who said, when you, as a reader, these characters are not real, mm-hmm. which I find shocking. How about as a writer? Are your characters real to you as a writer?
No. Well, now that you're shocked, I don't want to answer the question. I think that while I'm writing, I am within them, and I am I am them when I'm writing them. So in that sense, they're real, but I recognize that they're not real as I'm writing them. And that's, to me, what's interesting about writing, is it's a real tension between the fabrication, the thing that I'm fabricating, and the reality that I'm aiming for. And I don't think that it becomes reality. I think that it becomes something else. So I don't think of my characters being real. I think of them as being things that I've created. And I don't think that they have to do certain things. I think that I decide that they should do certain things. I don't, you know, a lot of people talk about characters having to, it's not my experience as a writer, but everybody writes differently and everybody has a very different relationship to what they create. But I think for me, part of what is interesting about writing is that craft issue, that issue of, you know, I'm creating reality and yet I'm not. I'm working with things that don't exist. So in that sense, no, they're not real to me. Shocking.
Would you like to comment on the reality of characters?
For me, they occupy my mind so much and inhabit landscapes. I guess I would say that my definition of what is real is fairly tied up in what I feel when I'm reading, and that for me, a lot of my real life is happening between me and the books I'm reading. But I understand the difference between the people I'm sitting at dinner with and the people in the books I'm reading. But I wouldn't in any way say that those figures in books are less important to me. And that goes the same with, you know, the characters that I'm writing about. It means the world to me. If it didn't, I wouldn't be writing. There's just so many more things to do. You know, there's just so much more to be doing. So it has to matter to me. And they have to be real in that sense of their mattering enormously. And watching them perform and, you know, making them perform and having them say lines that interest me and that entertain me and that educate me is everything. I was thinking, you know, what is it that makes a good artist? What is it that makes a good photographer or painter? Because I can see where you just get really interested in doing some other medium. And I guess that is the thing, just to be so sincerely invested in it that it means the world to you. So I don't know that that's exactly what you're asking, but I wouldn't in any way say that they are not real. I just wouldn't say that they are. I couldn't like reach over and squeeze their knee, but I live with them in a very real way.
And as a reader, I mean, there are so many characters that populate my head, that scenes from books that are as real to me as anything I've experienced, but there's
realer.
A difference. Realer. Yeah, there's times when I start to worry because my life feels like all that matters to me are the things that happen in the pages. They matter to me more than sometimes what's happening in my real life. That said, there is this difference, the reality between what I get up and deal with on a daily basis and the people I sit down to dinner with and whatever, and the people then who continue to live in my brain that are creations of someone else, and I'm grateful for those creations because they... And that's how I know when I've read something that's really touched me is they become real. And a book where I feel the character being manipulated by the author and moved around and put in position in order to reveal something... Those don't work for me in the way that ones where I buy into it with that suspension of disbelief. Do we have other questions? Yes, over here.
I have a question for the whole audience. Uh-oh. Could people put up their hands who are writers here?
Wow. Thank you.
My friend went to the movies once with her 2-year-old granddaughter, and before the movie started, it was 101 Dalmatians, her granddaughter stood up on her seat and says, "Raise your hands if you love puppies." The whole audience. I love that.
Very cool. Do we have any last questions before we wind up? But we have one over here, or you have one over there? Okay. Okay, thank you, Louise.
I was just wondering if you could speak to getting it down versus making it up, and like the tension between the two for you.
Well, Marissa asked earlier when we were having dinner if I wrote every day. That's essentially what you were asking. And I don't write every day, but I spend a whole lot of time thinking about writing and cogitating and worrying over scenes and characters and stuff that I witness in the world, like how would that play? Like just today, somebody was telling me about having been at a party where there was a drunk dog, and I was like, that would be so great. And I just like wrote that in my, but it's all in service of the story that I'm working on. It's sort of note-taking all the time for me, and I can hold it in my head for a fair amount of time before I commit it to the page, if that's what you're talking about.
Well, it's hard. I mean, you know, whenever there's always a brilliant story or a brilliant book in my mind, and then when it comes time to sit and write it, it falls apart and it has to, you know, be built up again, and it's never quite what was in my mind's eye. But you know, I guess that's I don't know how to answer that question because it's so hard. You know, it's to me that's the real struggle of it, is to take the idea and make it into something that sings on the page, and it's not just simply translating your thoughts, and it's not, you know. Or for me, I mean, there, you know, maybe people who think in scenes and they put them down and that's it. But it's a lot about that. Then you're dealing with craft issues, you know. It's like, how are you moving it along? How's the scene going to work? What's going to complicate the scene? What's, you know, how are we getting to know this person? What do we need to know at this point? I mean, those sorts of questions, I don't know, to me, they're very present when I'm writing. It's a very, it's not sort of an unconscious effort. You know, I mean, there's certain aspects of it which are unconscious. I guess the language is more unconscious for me. The actual mechanics of how a story works is a more arduous thing for me.
Which makes me ask, when you're crafting something and it's a first draft, just feeling your way through it thing, are you aware of those things at that time, or is that a second draft kind of hat you put on when you come back, or is that, can you have the creative side going while the editor's going at the same time?
I do. I mean, I don't think of them as being separate. You know, to me, part of the fun of it is all the kind of wrestle all those issues together and to make something, you know, seem seamless. Something that seems so impossible seems seamless. So I'm always thinking about that stuff. I don't know if you are.
I was just going to add that the process of revision was something that I came to a little reluctantly and probably a little late, but the whole idea that the best material is going to be arrived at in revision is very important to me. And my students are incredibly resistant to the idea of revision. For me, the idea that you first sort of unload the unconscious business that seems to belong together and then go back and apply a very rigorous critical eye is, you know, I can't imagine another way of writing anymore, but my students are very reluctant to think of it that way. They think it's either working on a first draft, and if it isn't, they abandon it, which I think is a mistake. A lot of the best stuff comes about in the,
you know, it's
15th
not unlike
draft.
You know, when you're writing and you're going through the process of revision, especially in terms of character, you know, you're getting to know your character. I mean, it's really not unlike getting to know a human being in real life. Here we are with the real again. But, you know, you meet somebody and you make certain assumptions about them based on very little knowledge, you know, what they sound like, what they're wearing, some comment they made about something, and you begin to form an idea of them. But as you get to know them more and more and you spend more time with them and you see them behave, you begin to deepen your understanding of them. And the process of writing for me is about, you know, laying down a very sketchy kind of character. She's got curly hair. She's got a funny little voice. She has, you know, something that in my mind locks her into something. But then it's a process of knowing her, seeing how if I put this situation in front of her, what are the ways that she could behave, and how would that expand my understanding of who she is as a person? That's the process of writing for me.
Okay, thank you.
I'd love to know both of your thoughts on the memoir, which is the new thing to read and write, and the new face of the dysfunctional family versus the fictional family. If you think that that's taken away from or taking credibility away from or watered down the fiction novel, family novel, and if you're conscious of that in your writing, or if you even if you address that when you're writing fiction family versus the new memoir family. How do you deal with that as a writer? Or do you at all?
I don't think much about it. I'm not a big reader of memoirs, and so I don't, you know, I've read kind of, you know, some of the maybe more prominent ones that have come out recently, but I don't think a whole lot about it. I mean, I guess one could say, you know, one could always say, what's the point of writing fiction when there's real life, you know, that offers up so much. But, you know, I think it's just, it's like what there's oil paintings and watercolors, there's collage, and I mean, there's just different ways of getting at. And, you know, the memoirs that I've read that I love the best read like fiction. You know, they read like, to me, like fiction. So I don't know. It's not something I actually think about. Maybe you have more to...
For me, it would be very difficult to write memoir because I feel as if when I'm writing fiction, the person I'm most likely to be exposing is myself, and I'm fine with that. You know, that is fine by me. But if I actually had to commit the names of my intimates to pages and to actually recount the things that, you know, they would not necessarily want recounted about them, or it would be paralyzing from the moment I began writing. I mean, the way that fiction is useful for me is in playing with facts in order to arrive at truth, but the idea that you're going to be faithful to facts and whether you arrive at truth or not is not even your point, is maybe. It's just a debatable process for me. I don't begrudge anybody doing it. It's interesting to me that the most famous of these, is it Frey? Whatever. Yeah. You know, he tried to sell that book as a novel first, and it wasn't a good story. I just think it's very, very enlightening that until he's claimed it was factual, it actually didn't seem like a story. And I just like the idea that I just don't know that many lives that conform to a story, and I'm more interested in story than I am somebody's real life. Because it's probably not going to be as interesting or as artful as a fictional rendition, to me. Yeah.
I want to thank you all for being here tonight. As you leave, keep in mind that there's that donation thing out there. If you enjoyed tonight's program, please help keep the library supported so that we can continue to offer these programs. And perhaps consider becoming a member of the library and supporting all that goes on here. Louise curates a fabulous Aloud series here, and I think it's the heartbeat of Los Angeles literature, and I hope that you'll support it, and I thank you for being here. If you would like your book signed, the authors will be out in the foyer there to sign books in just a moment. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.